Marvin, we'll absolutely dedicate to Andy Diamond this time with this learning, and it's such a tragic story.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right, welcome everybody. Parsha class. This week's Parsha, the Parsha is Parsha's Truma, but as you may have heard, there's a special Parsha that we read. There's a special reading that we read, a special reading, which is part of the Haftarah, which is the Maftir. We read what they call Parsha Zachor, which is the verses taken from the book of Devarim, Parsha Ki Tetzeh, which deal with the obligation to remember Amalek. Okay, we're going to get into that. And many shuls, it's a according to some, we'll get into that. It is a biblical obligation to hear the reading. And MJE has a socially distant reading, as all the synagogues do. And we'll get into that. But I want to get into the broader picture, the Parsha Zachor, to create a certain context. And we will start, of course, with a video. Here we go. All right. Okay, so I'm now going to share screen and we're going to go to the videotape. Okay.
Outpourings in two communities to say goodbye to 24-year-old Moshe Deutsch and 32-year-old Mindy Ferenz. We're also learning more tonight about the gunman seen armed and storming into that kosher grocery store in Jersey City. Those suspects now identified as David Anderson and Francine Graham. Also, this sober scene. Jersey City cops lining the street to pay their respects to fallen detective Joe Seals, also killed by Anderson and Graham. We have two reports tonight. We're going to begin with Eyewitness News reporter Jim Dolan. He's live in Jersey City with the latest. Jim.
Bill, the store where three innocent people died yesterday is all boarded up now. Police have all the evidence they need from it. But the larger investigation into what motivated a man and his girlfriend to four, maybe five murders is the subject of some debate tonight, even as Jersey City comes together to heal. Under heavy police guard at a memorial service at Temple Beth El tonight, the mosaic that is Jersey City came together to mourn the wrenching loss shared by all. The service was comforting, calming, candles and song, so stark a contrast to the echoes of yesterday. Four innocent people were killed in Jersey City yesterday, along with two gunmen, in a wild, hours-long gun battle with police. In video circulating online, which police confirm is part of the investigation, you see a man exit a van and start shooting into a kosher grocery store on Martin Luther King Drive. The kosher grocery store, with mostly Jewish customers and workers, was not a random target.
We know that they took out long rifles across the street after selecting this location and coming here.
New video of the store shows the horror of yesterday's attack. Shattered glass, overturned shelves, bullet holes everywhere. Much was made today over whether this was a hate crime, an anti-Semitic attack. The state attorney general says he's not sure.
We're standing in front of you telling you that we are conducting additional investigation before we reach any conclusions as to what the motivations were.
The mayor of Jersey City, though, is sure.
There is no question that this is a hate crime, and anti-Semitism should be called out aggressively and firmly immediately for what it is.
And some in the Jewish community say not calling this a hate crime directed at Jews is dangerous.
I never thought I'd see the normalization of anti-Semitic swastika graffiti. I never thought I'd see the normalization of anti-Semitic incidents on college campuses or in K-12 schools. We cannot allow the normalization of the murder of Jews in this, on American soil.
Again, there were two shooters, a man and a woman. The man is a known member of a group called the Black Hebrew Israelite Movement. That group is known to be hostile to Jews. The two suspects are both also suspects in the murder of a livery cab driver in Bayonne last week.
Okay. All right, so that was 2 years ago. I don't know if you guys remember, that was December 10th, 2019. And of course, let me just bring up the sheet for a moment. Just to give the facts. So on December 10th, 2019, an anti-Semitic shooting was perpetrated at the JC, that's Jersey City, kosher grocery store located in Jersey City, New Jersey. The 33-year-old female store owner, Mindy Ferenc, she was killed. 49-year-old male employee, Douglas Miguel Rodriguez, and 24-year-old male rabbinic student customer, Moshe Deutsch. So the story, this was, so the clip that I showed you had just been just right from where it had been, right after it occurred. So they didn't have all the information. Obviously, it's 2 years hence. So here's my question to you all. Did Moshe Deutsch have any sense of vulnerability when he went over to the JC grocery store to buy a sandwich? He was just taking a break in his learning. He went to go buy a sandwich, and then these guys came in. Alan says no. What do you guys say? Have any sense of vulnerability?
I would say no, but in the sense that we're all Jews, we're always vulnerable.
Right. So he, in a certain sense, there that's certainly true. But he walked in there. He was in yeshiva. He's taking a break in the middle of the afternoon. Maybe he missed lunch just to go to the, there was a new Jewish community in Jersey City. A Hasidic community had been developing. People had, Hasidim who were living in Williamsburg. Williamsburg has become a rather trendy area to live, and therefore the prices have become elevated. So they went basically across the water to Jersey City to buy and sort of build a community of affordable housing. That's what brought these Hasidim essentially to come to Jersey City. And there was a yeshiva there, and this guy went and he's a Satmar Chassid, and he's just taking a break and he's going to buy a sandwich, something that all of us at one time or another have done. And
we always have these moments where we're just kind of living our life. And then we get these alerts on our phone, and it's just like, oh yeah, like anti-Semitism is still alive and well.
Exactly, exactly. Unfortunately, he didn't get a chance to be alerted by it. Now the two shooters. Why did David Nathaniel Anderson and his girlfriend Francine Graham, who had a handwritten anti-Semitic manifesto found in the van, come into the grocery and start shooting?
They wanted to take out some Jews and be known.
Okay. What else, Alan?
I mean, that's, they knew that they could find Jews there.
Right. They'll be, if you're going to go to a kosher grocery store, likely, although tragically, one of the people that was shot was a guy who worked in the shop. That was Douglas Rodriguez. Now, just one of my colleagues at work at OUJLIC, Rabbi Joe Wolfson, who runs our downtown program at NYU, he brought a number of students there during the to do a shiva visit to the people there, and raise some money and help these people out, because these are not wealthy people. And even got money to the Rodriguez family, who, obviously a person from Ecuador or Colombia, not a wealthy person, and just devastating. But let's go a little deeper. So as Alan said, and what Marvin said, they're looking for some Jews. They want to kill some Jews. Let's go, that's it.
I will say one thing, just being in real estate, and this isn't the first attack in New York at this time leading up to this. There was multiple attacks in Crown Heights from, and I don't want to say it was, it was the African-American community that there's just a lot of tension because a lot of the people in Crown Heights are tend to buying north of Eastern Avenue, which is primarily Black neighborhood Bed-Stuy. And there's just a lot of tension with the gentrification. So there had been several attacks on other Orthodox people leading up to this attack in Crown Heights.
We also had the attack in Munsee, which is only about 3 miles from me in the Forche community area. And the man ultimately passed away. It was during Hanukkah of the same year. All these things were happening in a relatively short period of time. And up here in Rockland County, we also have that kind of tension where traditionally African-American neighborhoods have been taken over quite quickly and aggressively from the Hasidic community because they're growing. And yes, some of the places they had in the city are being taken over by people who may have lived here growing up and moved down to the more trendy areas like Williamsburg. So there are certainly a lot of complex issues going on, you know, with these type of things. Anti-Semitism is a big part of it, but there's some things that also feed into anti-Semitism as well, which is a little bit unique versus some other traditional right-wing anti-Semites, you know, and anti-Semitic incidents. But this was obviously a lot of classic anti-Semitism went into this Hebrew-Israelite group.
Right. This guy was not from that area, as best I can understand. He wasn't, in other words, he was not voicing the frustration that other people in the community had toward all these Hasidim suddenly moving into their community. There was that. In fact, but the key thing he wrote in he wrote an anti-Semitic manifesto, in other words, about how he wanted to destroy Jews. Now, why he picked this area. He was looking for, you know, he was looking at different communities. He was looking at Bayonne. I don't know why he was looking at that. I don't know, those are not the Jewish epicenters to find Jews, but whatever. And, you know, one of the silver linings in the entire story is that literally next door to the grocery store was a sort of an elementary school, what they call a cheder. A yeshiva katana, a yeshiva for elementary school boys, like I think 50, more than 50 boys in that thing. And if they would have gone to that room, if they would have gone to that thing, you would have had a horrible bloodbath of murdered, you know, the guy came tremendously loaded. He also had a pipe bomb, also in the, which they found the van. It was done how what happened was, they were talking about their plan, and a detective saw them in the saw them in the they were talking in a local cemetery. He approached them, and they shot him. And then, of course, they had to, you know, go ahead with it because they were planning where they're going to do. Therefore, they had to accelerate their attack, and this is what they did. So, but the key point, everything that you have said. Anti-Semitism is not something in the Purim story. Anti-Semitism is not something in the First and Second Temple period. Anti-Semitism is not something in the Crusades. It is not something which is limited to the Holocaust. Anti-Semitism is a reality that Jews have to be aware of and prepared for. And that's what this Shabbos is all about. It's not only about, we're going to get into it, it's not about going to shul and hearing the Torah reader read a section of the Torah, which contains literally three sentences. It's that, but much, much more. So let's get the information together and let's put into context. Okay, so let's go into, this is from the Shulchan Aruch. This is from the Code of Jewish Law. Let me have Shana read it out.
There are those that maintain that the reading of Parshat Zachor and Parshat Parah is a Torah obligation. Therefore, people living in an area in which there is not a congregation are obligated to come to a place that has a minyan for these Shabbatot. This is in order to hear these Torah readings that are Torah commandments.
Okay, so this is not just a regular thing. Now, I've been asked, of course, in COVID, it's a whole kettle of fish, different. Basically, Orthodox synagogues in the tri-state area are operating with the following protocol. which is basically you can't just come to shul, you need to sign up. Because why? Just like at MJE, because they can't have that many people because there's a limitation to the amount of people they can have in the facility. And everybody's got to wear a mask and everybody's got to be 6 feet separate, and they have to have plenty of ventilation so God forbid nobody catches COVID on the way to shul. Okay, now there are people who might be more compromised, another option is, if you can't do that, at the very least, read the Torah reading, which are three sentences, from a chumash at home, if you can't do that. Okay, so we'll identify what those three sentences are, okay? Let's get into, and the question I want to get to tonight is the listening of the reading the mitzvah or a call to action for the mitzvah? All right, so let's familiarize ourselves with the two stories or two accounts of one story of as the Jews have left Egypt and are making their way into the wilderness are attacked by this Amalek tribe. Okay, so key point is, it's not that the Jews, most important point, it's not that the Jews pulled up to adjacent to the Amalek tribe territory. The key words of the text we're going to get to is Vayavo Amalek, and Amalek arrived. In other words, they came looking for them. Okay, so let me have Marvin Bavakasha, if he can read it out. Marvin, you're on mute. We don't hear you.
There we go. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Let me just move this over. Amalek arrived and attacked Israel there in Rephidim. 17:9. Moshe said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and prepare for battle against Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." 17:10. Joshua did as Moshe had told him, engaging Amalek in battle. Moshe, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. 17:11, as long as Moshe held his hands up, Israel would be winning. But as soon as he let his hands down, the battle would go on in Amalek's favor. 17:12, when Moshe's hands became weary, they took, missing that word there from my screen, they took a stone and placed it under him so that he'd be able to sit on it. Aaron and Hur then held his hands, one on each side, and his hands remained steady until sunset. Joshua was able to break the ranks of Amalek and his allies with the sword.
All right, let me stop right there. So Amalek attacks, and Moshe, just to summarize, Moshe then tells Joshua, his right hand man, choose your warriors, and you're going to go to battle with Amalek. And okay, that's normal. And then he tells him, but there's going to be something different. I am going to go to the top of the hill overlooking the battle, and I'm going to bring my staff of God, the one that he used for the miracles, and he's going to stand there, okay? And then Moshe and Aaron and Hur, that's Miriam's husband, go up there, and now something very strange. As long as his hands were up, Israel won. His hands went down, the battle would go into Amalek's favor. So the Mishnah asks, Moshe's hands like the reason why they were winning? No, his hands, the Mishnah says, were up in prayer on behalf of the Jewish people. So it's not that that Moshe has the magical hands, but he's engaged in prayer when he's praying for the Jewish people, and the Jewish people see that their success is connected because of their connection to Hashem. That is the source of their success. Okay, but he goes on. So then Joshua was successful. He didn't destroy Amalek. He's able to weaken them, and they ran away. Okay, then it goes on. Marvin.
Okay. Hashem said to Moshe, Write this as a reminder in the book and repeat it carefully to Joshua. I will totally obliterate the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Moshe built an altar and he named it, God is my banner. He said, the hand of God is on God's throne. God shall be at war with Amalek for all generations.
Okay, so then we have a sort of very rather unusual ending where, you know, you would think this is a little battle. Okay, there are enemies, but they seem to be making a much bigger deal about this because Moshe first wants to memorialize this event in a, you know, in a book, number one. And two, is that now there's a command that they should obliterate the memory of Amalek. Okay. It's a little bit seemingly harsh. And then he says, the hand is on God's throne. God will be at war with Amalek for all generations. Now, apparently, why is God, you know, I understand these are enemies, but why is God sort of like gonna, making an oath, as it were, that he wants to be at war with the Amalek tribe for all generations? I mean, that seems to be a little extreme. Well, how do we explain that?
And wouldn't it be the Jewish people as opposed to God? Wouldn't God be able to destroy them just like you could destroy anything?
Well, there you go. So then, right. So, okay, that's good. So really, why is God saying that? Really, it's because God, if God wants to destroy, he was able to destroy the Egyptian army. He can destroy the Amalek tribe in a millisecond. Yeah, so what's going on? That's an excellent question, Marvin. But what is this idea of for all generations? Why is it, you know, first of all, why not? Well, that seems to assume that we're not going to be successful in wiping out Amalek. Because it says for all generations. How does he not know that next year we'll be successful and they'll knock him out?
I guess it's more of like the evil inclination is something that stays around even from different people, even if they're not necessarily descendant exactly from the Amalek people, but there is a spirit of Amalek, so to speak, that lives on.
Excellent. Okay, we're gonna circle back to that. That's an excellent observation, Marvin. Okay, now we're now gonna check out this is the section. It's only three sentences in Devarim, which we actually read in the Shabbat. This is the Parsha Zachor. And Alan, Bavakasha, if you can read this after everybody.
Remember what Amalek did to you on your way out of Egypt, 25:18. When they encountered you on the way and they were tired and exhausted, they cut off those lagging to your rear and they did not fear God, 25:19. Therefore, when God gives you peace from all of your enemies around you in the land of Egypt, in the land that your God, your Lord is giving, you occupy.
The Lord your God, the God your Lord is giving you to occupy as a heritage.
Yeah. You must obliterate the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. You must not forget.
Okay. So, how does the second account differ, whether it be on focus or even content, from the first story? What is the difference between?
It's kind of like after you've taken care of everything else,
yep,
you still have this thing on your back, Amalek.
Okay, good. But what seemingly, this is Moshe again. This is the Book of Devarim. Moshe's retelling the episode 40 years later. What is the highlighting? What is the omitting?
The subject before it was God who was going to destroy Amalek, and God was, and now it's the responsibility shifts to the Jewish people.
Excellent observation. What else?
I mean, it also dictates kind of like when they first encountered Amalek, it was out of a place of weakness.
Yes.
And when they encounter it the second time, it's after they've already accomplished all this great feat. So it's out of strength that they're destroying Amalek.
Right. So when they have created stability in the land of Israel, when they're fully expressed their sovereignty, they have an obligation to commit to the campaign against Amalek. Excellent. Now, the couple things is that there's no mention of Yoshua bringing the warriors to attack Amalek. It seems to talk about only the initial element. So apparently Amalek came and ambushed the Jews. And what do? Do they hit them frontally? No, they attacked them from the back and they kicked the straggler. They killed the stragglers. Okay. So then we have
this obsession with Amalek. Like, I don't get it.
We're going to answer that. Right. So that Alan's question really is the essence of the question. Like, what's up with Amalek? Okay. To be a nation is to have enemies. We're a nation. We have enemies. What's up with that? What is making Amalek so, what's the deal with this very super seemingly obsessive element with Amalek? I mean, just okay. Obviously, you got to defend yourself. Obviously, if they're enemies, you got to get them. What's up with them? What seems to be like an extra element here with Amalek?
There's a grudge. Also, like a seemingly a grudge, even if they're not attacking you, you still have to, like, there's a grudge here, which is very uncharacteristic of the Jewish faith.
Exactly. Yes, like, we're not supposed to hold grudges.
Right. We're not supposed to, you know, we're supposed to have reconciliation. We're supposed to have, you're not supposed to take revenge, and you're not supposed to, hold a grudge. And here, God has mandate. He tells Moshe, you write this down. And basically the obligation as Moshe understood is, this is a eternal obligation. And then I'm going to shift here to the Mishnah Torah, who codifies these mitzvot. This is not one mitzvah. It's actually two of the 613 mitzvot. Let's get into it.
Rabbi,
Shaina.
About Amalek as well. This wasn't a battle where the Israelites provoked them or had something to do with the land. This was them to the Israelites solely because they were the Israelites.
That's correct. That's a key element. In other words, what the Shaina is bringing out, and this goes back to the first line, Amalek arrived and attacked Israel there in Rephidim. The Amalek are not living in Rephidim, okay? And then the second element that to what Shin says, and not only that, they didn't attack them, who they attacked? They attacked the weak, the poor, the people who are schlepping along in the back there. So they did a sort of a sneak attack and attacked us. And notice they also had, and they did not fear Hashem. Like, how does that fit into the mosaic here? Okay. So we have to explain that. And I think the key element here, and before we get into the actual halachic obligation, the mitzvah obligation, is that basically the war on Amalek, and this ties into what Marvin is saying, the war on Amalek is not a war of defense. It's not a war of, trying to capture land, resources. This is an ideological war. The war, because fundamentally, Amalek is a nation, in contrast to Egypt, for example, who intrinsically cannot tolerate, hates God, apparently, and therefore, by extension, hates the Jews. Now, how do I even know that? Number one, the Egyptian army ran after the Jewish people, why did they run after them? This is a couple of parshas ago. Why did the Egyptian army run after the Jews?
The death of the firstborn might have irritated them a little bit.
That's not what they say. They told them to leave at that point. After they said go. What do they have a change of heart about?
About losing workers.
That's it, Marvin. That's it. They said, what are we, idiots? We are losing an entire slave nation. And they went to go recapture the entire Jewish people. That's not anti-Semitism. That is, I don't want to lose money. Go ahead.
Scott. But like they say that like not every Jew left. It was like a quarter, right? So even so, that was so like too much.
The Midrash, as you know, as you guys have learned with me, the Midrash uses exaggeratory language that a number of the Jewish people who were not going to leave actually died during the plague of darkness. But the bottom line is that says when it says Chamushim Alu, like a fifth. That I don't think that's to be taken literally, because if you have 600,000 men and that's only 20%, and you multiply that out, you're going to get a ginormous amount of Jews, which is I think is not to be taken literally. Medrash is using exaggeratory language to tell you that even though that the Jews saw
nobody
the
was
10
taking
plagues,
a census back then,
right? Yes, that even though that the Jews saw all the miracles, but leaving Egypt was, simply put, very, very hard. It was very hard, and some Jews could not do it, and did not want to commit to do that. So they were basically assimilated in. So they were not going to leave. So, but simply put, is that the plain reading is that the entire Jewish people were leaving, and I guess I don't know, is it 600,000 men, women and children as well, elderly as well, could be around 2 million people. That amount of people were, as Marvin pointed out, Paro had a change of heart that he was going to give up that that workforce. That's, free work, free workers. So that's not is that anti-Semitism?
Capitalism.
Right.
It's slavery, right. Yeah.
They had no problem with them, being Jewish. They just wanted to have the control of them. Okay?
They wanted cheap labor, yeah.
Yes, of the cheapest kind. I think they call that free labor. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, but Amalek is a different, as Shana pointed out and Marvin pointed out, is that these people, this tribe, seems to travel from an unknown place and attack the Jews. And like, why? What are you doing? And so it means that they're attacking them because they have an ideological hatred of the Jew. They can't tolerate the Jew's existence. As the verse says, they don't fear God. Okay? And therefore, we have an obligation to, the Jewish people have an obligation to eradicate our ideological enemy. This gets to a very interesting question, which I'm going to get to with the Rambam in a moment, is, was Amalek a tribe that existed? And we don't know, there are 200 countries around. We don't know of any Amalek countries, Or is it a biological tribe, or is it in fact
hereditary?
Is it biological hereditary tribe, or is it an ideological tribe that does not require the person to be genetically connected to the original Amalek people? For example, we're coming up on the holiday of Purim. It says Haman is Haman Ahagagi, Hamadasa Amagai. He's the Agagite. So the Medrash associates him with the king Agag, who in the time of Shaul, King Saul, was the leader, the king of the Amalek tribe. And so Haman is somehow connected. Now that's hundreds and hundreds of years later. So the question is, that not necessarily that he was, that Haman is not necessarily a biological descendant, but rather a ideological descendant. And that gets the big question in the room. Were the Nazis Amalek?
Well, there's an episode which some people may have heard of here, certainly, and I'm sure you have, took place in 1946 when one of the Nazis was being hung, and he called it Purim 1946.
Yes.
The story is that in the book of Esther, she says twice after, well, once after the sons of Haman had been killed, the ten sons.
Yes, ten sons of Haman.
Right, to kill them. She asked that they be killed, but they were already killed. So,
they'll be rehung again, just to display their bodies. Again. Yeah.
And since the letters are done in a certain way, it came out to the same year as 1946. So,
right. I've heard that. So that's a very remarkable coincidence. But I think the greater message is that it's interesting that these Nazi war criminals view themselves ideologically as being, you know, sort of like the children of Haman. That's actually very telling.
Marvin, you think you need Rabbi? We're going to need Rabbi Wilds for this. I think this is out of Rabbi Pinney's, like Kabbalah and Rebbe's and Brachas. I think you need to push that to Rabbi Wilds.
You can look it up also just on Google.
Right? This is a famous thing.
The facts and the story is real, but how it connects, I'm saying Rabbi Wilds.
That's beyond my pay grade.
All right, so let's take a look at the Rambam over here.
Anything.
No, but Rabbi Pinney, before we head there, but on a serious note, right, would we call, Saddam Hussein, right? Would we call him an Arab, or would we call him an Ishmael or an Amalek?
So we're going to, I'm going to get to, that's a good question. It's not so simple. In other words, we're going to get this question. Let me show you the facts inside, and then we'll revisit that question because it's an excellent question. Okay. Let me have Shana Reed, Vakasha. This is from the Rambam, Mishnah Torah.
It is a positive commandment to annihilate the seven nations who dwelled in Eretz Yisrael, as Devarim states, you shall utterly destroy them. Anyone who chances upon one of them and does not kill him violates a negative commandment, as the same book states, do not allow a soul to live. The memory of them has already been obliterated.
Now, so what the Rambam means is that the king of Assyria, King Sanherib, when he took over the northern part of Israel and the area, what he did was his strategy of gaining control over the region was what they call relocate. You know, his approach of assimilation and relocation. So he took people, say Moab and Midian and various tribes, he moved them to Turkey, and he moved the people who are in Turkey down to this area, so nobody feels any kind of connection to their land. And this way, he's able to in a more easy fashion, control the people. So therefore, the remaining tribes, the Canaanite tribe, the Amori tribe, the Hittite tribe, basically they're lost. So they've been obliterated because there's nobody walking around and says, "Hi, I'm a Canaanite." There are no red-blooded Canaanites walking around, and they have not existed for the last 2,700 years. That's courtesy of Sanherib. Now the key word here is similarly. The Rambam says similarly. That's going to come into important. That's an important simile. Go on.
Similarly, it is a positive commandment to destroy the memory of Amalek. As Devarim states, obliterate the memory of Amalek. It is also a positive commandment to constantly remember their evil deeds and their ambush of Israel to arouse our hatred of them. As also Devarim states, remember what Amalek did to you. The oral tradition teaches, remember with your mouths. Do not forget in your hearts, for it is forbidden to forget our hatred and enmity for them.
Okay, so the Rambam brings down, there are two mitzvot when it comes to Amalek. One positive commandment is to destroy them. And another commandment is to remember their evil deeds and the ambush, what they did. All right, and you're not allowed to forget them. So it's literally three mitzvot. You got to destroy them. You got to remember what they did. And three, you're not allowed to forget what they did. Okay, so three mitzvot. Now, the similarly is it similarly that the memory of them already been obliterated, and therefore there's no way to express that, Or similarly, is the more general that there's the mitzvah of just as the mitzvah to attack the seven nations, so there is every tribe of Amalek. Now the question comes down to, which is a debate, are, for example, let me read you something from Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah. Well, go ahead, Shana, keep on reading. I'm going to call upon Scott next.
If we search the entire world for a person more cowardly, despicable, weak, and feeble in psyche, mind, ideology, and religion, we would not find anyone like the Jew. Notice I do not say the Israeli.
Okay, so Hezbollah is a militia movement who lives in Lebanon and parts of Syria, and they have profound control of the Lebanese government. They're part of that government. They have funding. Their major source of funding is the Republic of Iran. And according to various intelligent reports, they have over 100,000 missiles, which are aimed at where, Scott Shapiro?
All of Israel, Jerusalem?
All of Israel.
I think they can hit all of Israel at this point.
They can have all of Israel. They're not just, and these are not just, sort of like unguided missiles. These are high-tech,
sophisticated ones.
Sophisticated weaponry, which they have been provided for by the Republic of Iran. In other words, Hezbollah is a proxy, what they call a proxy, for Iran. So that is a huge threat to the Jewish people. Now, the only reason that they're not launching that, because there was in Lebanon War II, the Israeli army and air force just flattened their various positions and places in Beirut and caused tremendous amount of thing. And therefore, they know they're going to get crushed. But on the other hand, you see that their chief, Hassan Nasrallah, has a profound, vicious, and toxic hatred toward the Jewish people and, of course, the state of Israel. So the question, just to ask you all, is Hassan Nasrallah an Amalekite?
Sure seems that way.
But certainly he's virulently anti-Semitic. So that really is the thing. Rabbi Soloveitchik's father of Moshe Soloveitchik maintained that in his reading of the Rambam, that it's not limited to the biological descendants of Amalek, but it's actually anybody who has this deep-seated, virulent anti-Semitism. Okay? Let me have Scott read the second
Wait,
quote.
Rabbi, once you say that, is that on the mitzvah of remembering or not do not forget or also kill and wipe out?
So according to him, that would be now an obligation. Now, who does that fall upon? The state, the Jewish state, like in other words, the state of Israel? They have to do that because that's sort of a, or is this is not obligation? Or is this anybody who's got a clear shot, got to shoot?
Wait, there's a mitzvah of Amalek on the congregation of Israel.
Well, in other words, that's why it says. In other words, there it's supposed to be done. This is by the way, notice where these halachas are from. It's the laws of the kings. In other words, the king is the head of state. So, for example, this obligation, you could argue, is on Bibi Netanyahu. Now, he's got to use his wisdom. He's got to work it out that he doesn't want to do something and then cause more Jews to die. So he got this is.
Well, and he's also in charge of the Mossad and the IDF.
Right. So you should know, and those people, and I mean this, you should know, part of understanding our enemies, you need to become educated and well-read about what's going on. There have been near daily attacks by Israeli forces, covert, to stop Iran putting in various parts of infrastructure, exporting it from Iran to Syria to Lebanon, which will create sort of a vice, a noose around Israel. And basically, it's a non-war war. It's basically Israel having to, shall we say, mow the lawn against the Iranians covertly, whether it be in throughout Syria and even Lebanon, to ensure that they don't get their high-powered, high-tech armaments in place to really do profound damage to the state of Israel, okay? So now, not everybody agrees with that. Other people maintain that, no, just as it says that their memory of them been obliterated, similarly also applies to that there's no obligation, technical obligation in our day and age. It's only limited to the biological Amalek. We don't have a biological Amalek. There is no practical way to accomplish this. Okay, so
wait 1 second. I didn't realize how slick you were here. You threw in the Shulchan Aruch earlier, and now we have the Rambam in the Laws of Kings. Yeah. So according to the Rambam, do I have to go to shul on Shabbos and listen to the Parsha Zohar?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Excellent question. So the Shulchan Aruch says there are those who say that position is a position of the Balei Tosfos. Okay, the Tosfos, that's Rashi's grandchildren who wrote that. The Rambam says is listening to the reading of a Amalek, is that enough?
Or does only Rabbi Bibi or Bibi Netanyahu had a statement to do it for me?
Okay. So it seems the Rambam has in his other thing that there are a thing called the four parsha before Pesach reads four special readings. One of the reading we read before Purim is Parsha Zachor. You could say that is just to understand, as just as a foreshadowing to get us into the Purim state of mind. It's not, and it would be not an obligation according to him. But the Shulchan Aruch says there are those who say, so therefore, if you have a doubt about a biblical obligation, we do our best to try to cover it. It is far from clear if the Rambam holds that. Either, in other words, you could learn it a couple ways. Number one, it does nothing to fulfill your obligation. Number two, the yearly reading is a minimalistic practice to be able to keep the memory going. Okay, that's another possibility. All right.
So those are two possibilities. Keep the memory going, meaning not forget,
not forget the reality. In other words, the nature. What is? Let me step back one step. If the Torah says do not forget, what is the assumption that the Torah has? Very simple.
It's natural to forget.
That we might forget.
We might forget. Now, why would we want to forget?
Because who wants to dredge up bad times? You don't want to like rehash like the worst parts of our history.
Exactly. Don't want to bring up painful parts of our past. That is natural. Not only that, but what does Amalek really teach us as fundamentally, as a truth about our Jewish existence?
Precarious.
Yes. And why is it precarious?
We have enemies, and they act upon their feelings.
Well,
what kind of enemies? Something very specific.
That don't relent. So we have to continue to fight.
We have unrelenting enemies, but there's something very special about these enemies.
They're fighting against God and then against the Jews that represent God.
It's not a war. Most wars are for resources. You have land I want. I'm going to go to war to get that land. You know what I'm saying? You have oil that I want. I want that oil. I want that money. Okay. Most wars are for resources, gaining control of a place. Okay, so here, what's unique about the War of Amalek? It's not about resources. It's, in other words, they just can't stand the idea that there'd be a Jew.
There's also wars about religions, especially in the medieval times. The war between, you know, the Muslims and Christians in Spain, to which the Rambam was, you know, privy to.
He was victimized. He had to run for his life. He was going to be forced converted. Scott, I want to bring in the second quote from Hassan Nasrallah. Scott Shapiro, please read it out.
The Jews invented the legend of the Nazi atrocities. Anyone who reads the Quran and the holy writings of the monotheistic religions see what they did to the prophets and what acts of madness and slaughter the Jews carried out throughout history. Anyone who reads these texts cannot think of coexistence with them, of peace with them, or about accepting their presence, not only in Palestine of 1948, but even a small village in Palestine, because they are a cancer which is liable to spread against any moment.
Okay. So notice, Adrian, Hassan Nasrallah, who I think is a Shia Muslim, frames his anti-Semitic in what terms?
Well, there's no possibility of coexistence. Like what I see as a qualitative difference between the Jews and other religions, in that, you know, the Christians or the Muslims, they're mistaken. But the Jews were not just mistaken in not recognizing the true prophet. It's not just that we're mistaken in that, it's that we are intrinsically evil. Like, not just mistaken, but intrinsically evil.
Now, why does he have to say this first part? The Jews invented the legend of Nazi atrocities. Why is it important for him to be supportive of Holocaust denial? Why does that have to be a thing for him?
Cognitive dissonance. It's simple. You know, you don't want the enemy to be the victim because it just doesn't resonate within the mind.
Okay. Anybody else, guys? What do you guys think? Alan?
I just think it kind of goes to like the cry wolf aspect of like the history of the Jews. Like maybe his mentality is like they've always been saying that they've been, you know, had these atrocities against them. You know, this is nothing different than what they've claimed in the past.
Right. No, his approach is there could be no validation. In other words, nothing positive can be said about the Jew. Oh, they've been victimized. They lost 6 million. No, they haven't. It's a lie. They're the aggressor. They kill prophets. They're a cancer. And we can't even give them one speck of land in Palestine. Not even a small village.
That's the word cancer. Cancer. That's the word. Something that's intrinsically bad.
Correct. So I don't know whose reading of the Rambam is better. Would the Rambam was here today, would he say, certainly this guy is a virulent anti-Semite. And obviously, by the way, you should all know that Hassan Nasrallah does not sleep in the same bed two nights in a row. Does anybody know why that is?
He's afraid of being killed. He knows he's a target. Israel has killed other of his predecessors. And so he always has to sleep with one eye open in a new spot on a regular basis.
Exactly. Exactly. So the bottom line is, what I'm arguing tonight is that whether the reading of Parsha Zachor is a biblical obligation or a rabbinic obligation or a custom, whatever category halakhically fits into, one thing's clear about what the Rambam is teaching us is that we have an obligation to be aware of and deal with and accept a painful reality. And that's what Parsha's Purim is. There are people, for no reason, just for ideological reasons, want to destroy the Jewish people. And if the Jewish people get lulled into a sense of comfort and denial, that is just asking for trouble. So when you hear Parsha Zachor, to recognize that there is a Malek. A Malek has not, in essence, gone away. And therefore, it's incumbent on us to do some of the basic things. So number one, I'm just going to list four areas, and you guys can give me more ideas. But I think to support the IDF and the lone soldiers who are there, who when we were in Israel, are basically dealing with people who want the death and destruction of the Jewish people. There are people who are working, you know, in shifts 24/7, monitoring and dealing with the largest threat to the state of Israel, which is the Republic of Iran, who are developing their nuclear capabilities, enriching their uranium. Israel, it's unofficial, pulled off a daring and amazing feat a couple months ago, 2 months ago, when they killed the top Iranian scientist who was the mastermind behind the entire nuclear program, which they got the record saying the goal is, in a oil-rich country, is not to be able to have clean, affordable nuclear energy, but it really is as a vehicle to enrich and create nuclear warheads so they can gain ever great domination in the Middle East. So therefore, the Jewish young men and women who every day are putting themselves in life to ensure that the Jewish people, the state of Israel, are supported from the enemies of Israel, the Amalek level anti-Semites, and the other anti-Semites, okay? We got to be supportive of them, okay? So, and you go on their website, they have a number of ideas. Next, you got to be involved in organizations that combat anti-Semitism. I just picked, ADL is one, a very well-known one. And then there's something which is very critical. You need to become educated. You cannot live in a bubble imagining that there are no threats. This website, this organization, curates, gathers, as does the ADL, all the anti-Semitic events that are occurring around the world every single day. It's not like, I just picked, the tragedy in Jersey City that happened 2 years ago, and then 2 weeks later, down the block from Marvin Baum's home in Rockland County, where a guy came in and stabbed a number of people celebrating Hanukkah, there are things going on, which are, of course, less, nobody's getting killed, but swastikas. On one of my campuses, Jewish guy is in the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. They were egged, but why was he egged? Because he's a Jew, you know what I'm saying? Just could be a low-level anti-Semitic thing or swastikas painted.
I mean, it's in our Congress. When you have Ilhan Omar, condemning Israel, and you have the Gang of Five, condemning what Israel is doing. I mean, anti-Semitism is here in our own congressional delegations that have to be defended against.
Alan, we as Americans have been for the last, 50 years have enjoyed a tremendous time of serenity, of feeling safe as American Jews, and America has been what they call Medina Shel Chesed, a country of kindness to us, the Jewish people. But we don't, that is not necessarily forever. And another element, and this is something that maybe Shana can speak to, is that there's an organization, a Legion, which teaches Krav Maga, and there are others that teach that a Jew must defend themselves. Okay? You cannot, I'm not saying that you can be a Rambo and fight everybody and everything, but there is some self-defense basics. And not to mention, right before COVID, I don't know if you know, this sounds like a million years ago, but the biggest issue in the Jewish community, like a minute before COVID, was dealing with the fact that shuls and schools and Jewish community centers, many of them were trying to work out ways and not become obvious, soft targets. So as we, God willing, emerge out of COVID, we have to, this issue of anti-Semitism, it's not going away. And what's America, I mean, like, and also, you know, Alan mentioned anti-Semitism on the left. Well, there's anti-Semitism on the right. On the attack of the Capitol, we had people wearing the Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt. There are people who are, you know, white supremacists, Proud Boys, QAnon, all these people. Among them are people that hold extremely harsh, virulent anti-Semitic views. We have anti-Semitism on the left. We have anti-Semitism on the right. You know, we got anti-Semitism all over the place. So my point is, Parsha Zohar says, the reason why we, at the very least, is to the Jewish people, wake up. The reason why God said that Amalek is Lador Lador, because until the Messianic era, Jews have to deal with the reality of virulent anti-Semitism. Now, you have to do things that you can minimize it. You can mitigate it. You need to become educated. You need to become activated. You need to become even engaged in your own personal defense. Adrian, you had a question. Okay, good.
Rabbi, so, I was going to just say one thing.
Marvin, then Alan.
I don't know if you recall this, but back in 2016, two rabbis' homes here in Rockland, actually in New City where I live, were attacked. I was in one of those homes at the time. That was the first attack. It was about 10:30 at night, or a little before 10:30 at night. We were just finishing saying a very late Myra service after celebrating one of the rabbis' birthdays. Nice. And suddenly there was a large explosion. It turned out it was an M98 under the gas tank of a car, which was right in front of the house, very close to where I was standing. I was indoors. Fortunately, the gas tank did not blow up. There were young children in the house in their bedrooms upstairs. And then a few moments later, we heard another explosion. The first one we thought maybe was a transformer. The next explosion took place at the other rabbi's house from Chabad of Rockland, and that was about a block away. And there were people home at the time. The tree, a bush actually, caught fire, and it was immediately next to the house. And fortunately, they called the fire department and got there very quickly, so the house did not catch fire. So this kind of stuff can happen anywhere. I had met with the town supervisor prior to this incident to talk about anti-Semitism with some of my neighbors, because there was some of the festering anti-Semitism there. And yes, some of it does involve aspects of the Jewish community where they don't always act in the best ways when it comes to some local school districts with sensitivity when they're taken over by the Hasidic and ultra-Orthodox community, or when housing is done in such a way that people who've lived in communities for many years are suddenly kicked out of their homes so that those homes can be taken down and new larger homes built specifically for the ultra-Orthodox community. So there's a lot going on here. But there's also just some very classic anti-Semitism when you're walking with a yarmulke and somebody shouts at a car, you know, from you, you know, effing Jews, you know, get out of this area, whatever, you know, those kind of things, which have been happening. And so, you know, I've tried to keep on top of it. The next morning, the police, unfortunately, did not take that incident seriously. They thought it was just some, you know, teenage mischief type of stuff. So they did not properly investigate. And I started just going online to everybody that I knew, every text number I had for the town supervisor, for the council people, for leaders in the community, even from the conservative synagogues and the Board of Rabbis here in Rockland County. And the next morning, Evan Bernstein, who was in that video, called me, you know, fairly early in the morning, and he wanted to get the whole story, and they helped to get the story out, and it did become news even in Israel.
This attack.
So just, you know, again, the police told me that it was he was getting off at 11 o'clock. So he was only there for a few minutes taking a report down, and he was leaving. They didn't call the arson squad in. They didn't call anybody else in for an investigation or even to try and catch these people. they know who they are, but they unfortunately, they were going off to college and everybody clammed up. And so they were never caught. They know who they were, but they were never caught.
Because
the police did not act in response right away. They didn't, the officer did not understand what anti-Semitism was. I've never seen the quotes that you gave. I know that Hamas has in their charter against the Jews, not just the Israelis.
In the Hamas charter is the destruction of the Jewish state. But allegedly they differentiate, they want to say, we're not anti-Semitic. We're anti-Zionist.
I think they also say that they're against the Jews too.
That's right. The ADL did a study. They have in Gaza has a 98% anti-Semitic views, not just limited to Israel and the Zionist entity. So
the Nasrallah quotes that you gave would never be shown on TV when there's a war between Hezbollah and Israel. They're going to put Hezbollah as somehow the underdog.
We haven't even touched about that, by the way, is a huge topic, and we don't have that much time, but nor is it that when Israel is being presented in the media subtly, we're being painted as the aggressor, the unjust aggressor. Alan raised his hand. I want to go to Alan, and then I want to go to Chaim.
Yeah, I just had a question, just for maybe your opinion, like with the Holocaust. I mean, I know some Jews try to defend themselves, especially like in the Warsaw Ghetto. But do you think that that generation kind of forgot about this and didn't like train themselves to fight off as much as they could have? I mean, I know that's kind of a loaded question, but and then the. The second question is, as Jews, should we like learn how to get guns? I have my shotgun rifle permit in New York City. You know, that's more for sport, but that's not for like a fear of anti-Semitism. And one of the other ways that I protect myself is like I wear a baseball cap on Shabbat, and that's when I wear my yarmulke. I only wear it on Shabbat. And, you know, when I'm leaving shul or anything like that, I make sure to wear a baseball cap because you never know.
Right.
Kind of what crazies.
All right. So that's a mega topic. In a different class, I discussed the issue that the Jewish community has to be able to protect itself. In Europe, it seemed that over the centuries, the Jews were persecuted, that they were not allowed to organize and provide this kind of protection. And it's something that for whatever reason, you could just claim that they just were not allowed to protect themselves as a community. Okay. I'm not saying America is not the government of America as large, writ large, is not an anti-Semitic regime by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not saying that everybody in the United States government loves Jews, but we're not there yet. But it could be an error for Jewish people to not have to take their self-defense in a serious manner. And we have to work within the laws of the country. But certainly for a Jew to learn self-defense, this was there's this organization called Legion that trains people to be able to become for self-defense. Many people after that episode with Marvin, the various episodes that happened in Rockland County, many people did go ahead and get, gun permits. Now guns, by the way, gun permits, it's not so simple because not just simply getting a gun. Because you need to be trained on how to use a gun because you can actually cause more damage than just by having a gun. So it's not just getting a gun. It's getting a gun and getting trained to use it properly and safely because many questions came up, when the anti-Semitism, really hit December 2019, January 2020, people who had guns say, hey, Rabbi, should I bring my gun to shul? You know what I mean? So, I appreciate that, and I love, you know, I love that spirit. But in other words, you know, you're not in a situation where there's a live shooter. You can actually end up shooting people. You know what I mean? To be able to handle a gun in very extreme situations requires much training. And you know, we watch movies, we think it's like so simple. No. When people are trained with firearms in the police and in army, it's months, and it requires lots of practice and training. So having said that, but it's within the it's full within a Jewish ethic to a Jew and the community should defend themselves, period. And if it's appropriate and wise to get to have a gun, should have a gun. But I know a little bit about that is that it's not so simple just to have a gun. You gotta train. You gotta practice.
I actually messaged you privately because I wasn't sure if it was appropriate to bring up, but we got there. I guess is my husband finally talked me into going to a gun range, and it was literally all religious Jews on a Thursday night. It was like. That, like, I joked we could make a minion. Because that was literally like tzitzis, kippahs. I think there was a couple on a date. I mean, it was definitely interesting with ultra right wing news on the speakers, which was actually the worst part of it. But anyway, but it was all in that kind of vein, is people being like, okay, we need to learn how to use them, right? Because
I'm going to try to be as apolitical as possible. I'm asking, try to answer Alan's question without getting the complexity of gun laws and gun rights in America, yeah, et cetera, and the Second Amendment and all the kind of jazz. I'm just saying simply, it's an obligation for the Jewish community to be able to protect itself. The beautiful expression of that, of course, is the IDF in Israel, but also communities outside the land of Israel have to do it. We can do it together in concert but the question is, can we outsource 100% our own protection to the local authorities? To answer that question is a little bit above my pay grade.
The joke in my house is...
I think Jews should learn how to defend themselves. I think Jews should learn the basics of self-defense. They should not be victimized. One of the most terrible things that I saw, compilation videos of discernible Jews just being, beaten up in Brooklyn, just because they're, taking the guy's black hat and messing with the guy. If there were, I'm not into vigilante justice, but if somebody comes to get you, you need to be able to not be a soft target. I'll leave it like that. So, and I'm not qualified to identify what are the things that you need to do to become not a soft target. I encourage, like I do about everything, you need to go to experts in Krav Maga, experts in personal protection, and whatever that is, that you have no right to be a victim. That's what I'm just saying. You become not a victim, whether it's Krav Maga and the similar and the defense. First of all, I think a woman has an additional obligation not to be messed with. They should learn the basics of self-defense, not from being a Jew. It's A. And B, on top of that, the issue of, being a gun owner and a gun carrier, or just at least a gun owner, if the person's going to go on that route, they need to take the time to become adept and to make sure that instead of you're going to be a gun who's going to be dangerous to themselves, but actually, properly learn how to do it in a proper and, of course, lawful way. This is a juicy topic. We can go all night long. Chaim, you get the last word, 30 seconds. That's it. I don't want to keep your mouth all night.
I wasn't talking to Cole about guns, but just to get clear, because we're talking about Amalek and where it comes into anti-Semitism. And like with Marvin mentioned, right, in Muncie, right, is anti-Semitism considered baseless hatred because they're Jews, because of a thing against God and the Jews represent? In other words, if there are people that decide to change the zoning laws and build four family houses and bring traffic and this and that and bad public schools, right now because they're doing private schools. They don't want to pay. They don't care about the non-Jews, right? Or they have an anti-non-Jew thing because the Goyim are bad, or Esav Sona as Yaakov, right? So now, and post-Holocaust generational stuff, is that considered a Amalek anti-Semitism, or is that considered we provoke them and that's nothing to do with this?
Excellent question. Mega topic, but let me give you a 25-cent answer to your $10 question, which is that, $100 question, which is that we as Jews can provoke unnecessarily and crazily provoke non-Jews for no reason. I'm saying there might be a latent anti-Semitism, but we as Jews can make it worse. And that's very simple. And therefore, the best defense for anti-Semitism is a good offense, which is being a good, considerate neighbor to and coworker wherever you are. Be a mensch. Whatever you would not want to do for yourself, don't do to others. And that's that. So, yes, Jews can make it worse. In fact, Jews do make it worse. So I don't want, you know what I'm saying? So it's not.
I'm not even talking about stocks that made off in Wall Street. We're just talking about.
I'm not saying that they're all bad. We're angels and we're being victimized.
Or having big weddings and refusing to wear masks.
Correct. Exactly. So overtly flaunting COVID laws, which of course affect everybody. I'm upset about that too. I'm not an anti-Semite, so the answer is, Chaim, I think I've answered your question. Yes, we as Jews make things worse, and we have an obligation to avoid it at all costs.
We're not going to call that anti-Semitism a Amalek.
No. By the way, not every anti-Semitism is of the Amalek flavor. Amalek is the most hardcore variety. There could be just the person's jealous of a person's success. You know what I'm saying? Not all anti-Semitism is the same. Okay. We, you know, like the Eskimos have, 50 flavors of snow. We have more flavors of anti-Semitism. All right. I don't want to hold everybody up. Everybody have a great night and to be continued.
Thanks, Rabbi.